Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, where you learn what you need to know about how the world wants to work. And now your host, coworking space owner and trend expert, Jamie Russo.
Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast. Happy holidays. If you are listening to this podcast when it launches, we are getting serious about the holiday season here, almost there. Hope you are listening to the podcast on your way to spend some time with friends and family or get some skiing in like we are going to do. I cannot wait. Huge welcome to the founding members of Community Manager University. We launched last week. We've got a great group of folks in for the founding member launch. Slack group's up. We're doing our first Q&A on Wednesday and lots of content loaded into the core modules with more to come. If you are interested in getting involved when it opens back up in 2020, you can go to everythingcoworking.com/community managers to get notified. Also, if you are thinking about or working on opening a coworking space, I launched an ebook, 8 Steps to Creating a Profitable Coworking Space That You Love to Run. I wanted to condense a lot of the things I talk about on the podcast into a written version for those of you that like to read in addition to listen. So you can find that on Amazon. You can search for coworking or my name is probably the fastest way to get to it, Jamie Russo. Really looking forward to sharing today's episode with you. Casey Godwin is a repeat guest. I try to repeat folks that just bring a ton of practical value to you. And if you are looking for a space, this is a great episode for you. Or if you already have a space, but are thinking about expanding, also some great detail to help you work through the proposal process for a commercial real estate space. So Casey walks through the elements of a proposal for a commercial office space and his advice and watch out points. He gets super detailed, which I personally love because he's really demystifying a process which most of us have never gone through before. And he has such a solid lens on our business model. So he is a broker by training, but now does a lot of kind of as a consultant wrapped up into a broker. So he still does brokerage work, but he's really tuned into our business model, understands the unique implications of what we are doing with space and overlays that on his process. And he just really wants folks who are starting spaces to be successful. So he puts a lot of passion behind what he does. And so we get along really well in that sense. So he is on the show today, walking through the elements of a commercial real estate proposal. And it's a bit of a lengthy episode. So without further ado, let's dive in. Hey there, I am back on the podcast with Casey Godwin, who is the president of FlexSpace Advisors. He was on episode 118. If you love what you hear today, definitely go back and listen to him. He's one of my favorite people to chat with in the coworking industry. He is out and about and helping folks find space. He is broker by training, I guess, but also like business plan guy, pro forma guy, a little bit of everything. Yeah. He
broker by training and consultant by necessity.
Right. So, I mean, but that's one of the things I love about Casey. He dives in and he gives and really wants his clients to be successful. And he understands the co-working industry like very few out there. So he's one of my favorite folks to catch up with. And we are going to talk today about the proposal process. So he's going to dive in. Casey, I'll let you do an intro here and get into our topic, but we thought this would be useful. Thank you for joining me again today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I look forward to this for a long period of time. And it's been a long time coming and I do appreciate your invitation to kind of be on here more often and share my input of what I've seen out in the streets and what landlords are doing, what tenants are doing, and kind of it's constant evolution. So the more we kind of stay in touch, the better, and I'll keep up to speed. So I thought today would be a good time to talk about just some key things. You know, most of my clients in the co-working world, they're on different levels. Some have limited exposure to real estate, some have a broad experience. So this discussion will kind of be higher level. And I'll kind of talk to the group as if there's one basic understanding of what the real estate terms are. In certain areas, and if based on your students and your feedback, if you want me to kind of give a glossary, definition of what something is, or give a little bit more meaning there, I can do that. But
I'll interrupt you freely.
Yeah, I want to talk about just high level. What are some of the key things to make sure that you have in a proposal when you're negotiating business terms with a landlord or a potential property owner? And then we can kind of talk about the most important things first, and then we'll kind of just go down and some other miscellaneous things I think are important, and especially to iron out on the front end. So probably the first thing to explain is the process. So once you've selected a property and you've toured it and you like it, one of the first steps is sending an RFP. It's a request for proposal. And typically it'll state, who the client is, and it'll put in building information and talk about some information that you'd like to receive from the landlord or the landlord's broker when preparing a proposal. So you don't have to go in this order, but if you are going extremely formal, this is how it would work. Start, the tenant rep broker would send out an RFP. The landlord responds with a proposal, typically in their form. And all brokers have their own forms they like to use because they own their own language. So they would respond back with their proposal, and then you would start proposal exchanges. So we would mark up the proposal, send it back to the landlord, and you do two or three exchanges until you get some terms that are mutually agreeable. And then at that point, there's typically a signature block at the bottom. It's easy as just changing the terminology at the top and the bottom of the proposal from a proposal to a LOI or letter of intent. And then both parties would typically sign. Now, I want to kind of clarify for everyone, an LOI is not a necessity. You don't have to have it in order to just move on to a lease. In fact, it's not non-binding. So you're not bound to any of the terms that you agreed. It's essentially a handshake agreement on, here's what we agreed to. Let's take this document, hand it over to the attorneys. And so they're being brought up to speed on what the terms we agreed on, and they can use that for drafting the lease. So that's the intent of a letter of intent. I don't see a point of it. I typically just keep it as a proposal, PDF it, and date it, and say, this is the date that we agreed on this proposal, and let's move this forward. So that's kind of how I operate, but kind of starting from the top of
I'm going to jump in. So the purpose of going through this phase of the process is to make sure that you're basically aligned on the high level deal terms before you spend a lot of money on attorneys to do an actual lease, right? So yeah, you're going to walk us through what's included in there, but it's really to make sure, okay, this is a deal that both parties are willing to do, and then go ahead. And then you probably will get into this, but once you start actual lease negotiations, then the landlord is negotiating with you in good faith. Is that correct? So he can't be negotiating and writing leases with two different people at once.
No, that's not true.
Oh, good. correct me.
So they could be negotiating with another tenant. It would be maybe borderline unethical, and it would be frowned upon for sure, but there's no law that says they can't.
Okay.
It's not like a law if you have a purchase agreement and you're exchanging those, that's a different thing.
Okay.
This is just a proposal. And so once you get to the lease, the only reason why the landlord would not want to do that is he or she does not want to spend attorney fees twice.
Sure.
So typically they'll take the person to the dance, they'll see if they can make it work. If not, then they go back to the party and figure out if they can find another tenant to work out.
Another date. Okay.
Yes. Find another date.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah. And the proposal, the main point of it is let's figure out what are the main things that are important to us and then pass it over to the attorneys. A lot of times when you take it to an attorney, the attorneys only handle the legal items of the lease.
Yeah.
They do not really deal with the business items.
Yeah.
That's what the brokers and the principals of the deal are intended to handle. So I think it's important to iron everything out up front and then pass it on to the attorneys. And so it kind of creates a separation there for responsibilities, plus timing. I think time is more important than even the cost for attorney fees, because a lease can take you 3 to 4 weeks easy to,
best case.
To work through.
I mean.
Yes. So it would be a shame to get through all that and then find out that there's a major key item that, you know, could have been ironed out in a proposal, and then that's a deal breaker and you have to start all over. So
and you don't get your money back. There's no refund if you don't actually sign the lease. You're still paying your attorney.
Exactly. And yeah. I always advise my clients that you're going to get the most leverage with all these business terms while you're negotiating proposals. After that point, once you get into a lease, you lose leverage. And so what you want to do is have everything documented in a way that when you do send it on to the landlord and so they can draft the lease, you can always have them refer back, hey, no, look at this proposal. This is where exactly we ironed this out. This is our points. And so they won't retrade on you. So you need to have that precedent in there.
Yeah. So while you're working through the proposal, they're sort of trying to win you over and they're in that mindset of like, we want this to work. And then yes. As soon as you go to the lease writing, they don't want to give anymore. So they're trying to protect and not. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. So while you're in the dating stage, you know, for the proposals, I think that's when you take as much, you know, leverage as you can. So first off, I think it's important to note that my proposals are a bit more in depth than I think your run-of-the-mill proposal. Typically, the average proposal is going to be anywhere from 2 to 3 pages. Mine's closer to 7 pages when you get to the end. So some of these things are pretty in-depth. In fact, I do remember one landlord asking me a question, says, okay, well, when I sign this lease, you know, when do y'all move in? I was like, no, this is not the lease. And the lease is going to be probably 60 pages. This is only 7. So yeah, it's just a matter of perspective there. Mm-hmm. But this is intended to be a watered down version of the key points. So it's easy enough for everyone to explain. It's just, you know, watered down to the most important things. And then we pass it on. The attorneys add all the colorful language that makes it really hard to understand. So on the first, you always start with the premises. You always want to define what the space is that you're negotiating for. And if there's, sometimes that's a defined premises, or it could be open-ended. If you're taking a partial floor, you might make a range there. So it's always important to kind of set that apart. But in doing that, I think it's important, really important for co-working groups to figure out what the common area factor is, and not only for the building, but for the specifically the floor. And so different parts of the country will define common area factor differently. Sometimes they call it an add-on factor or a building factor. But ultimately what it does is it separates a usable square foot that is contained within your premises. And then the rentable square feet is what you actually pay for. So that delta equates to common areas in the building, whether it's the lobbies downstairs, the elevator banks. If you're on multi-tenant floor, it could be the corridors and restrooms that are shared with other tenants on that floor. So if you're on a single tenant floor, you'll have a lower common area factor, which is important because you want that common area factor to be as low as possible. Because in the co-working business, you're looking at revenue producing space versus non-revenue producing space. So if you add to the non-revenue producing space, you're just paying on an expense that you're not compensating or covering up with revenue. And so you're going to be less profitable with a really high common area factor. So older buildings that were built in, let's say, the 60s, 70s, 80s, with really large atriums. Think of Die Hard, that huge atrium. That's probably like a 20% common area factor for that building. So ideally, you don't want to be in a building like that because it's going to be really, really high. But if you can take a full floor of the building, then that's going to help minimize it. So typically, some rules of thumb, if you're on a single tenant floor, you'll be around single digits. So you want to be under 10% for a single tenant floor for the common area factor. And for a multi-tenant floor, you're going to be somewhere between 14 and let's say 18%. Some rule of thumb there. Term is an important thing to consider when you're negotiating, because a lot of times you may have multiple terms. You may have 7-year term versus a 10-year term, and you're wanting them to give proposals for two different scenarios. So always identify which kind of term you're looking for in this space. I always advise my clients to go for a longer term because this is a commitment and you want to lock in the rental rate so you can lock in and guarantee what your expenses are going to be for your pro forma, but also to protect the asset. You're creating a beautiful space. you're putting a lot of fixtures and equipment into it, and you want to make sure that no one can come in, sweep it in underneath you and take away your biggest asset, which is, you know, all your business and your community. So it's important to define what the term is. Commencement date, another important thing. So some landlords will say, once you sign the lease, that you need to start paying rent. And that's kind of kind of sleazy, in my opinion, because you haven't even started construction yet. So how are you supposed to start paying rent if you can't use the space? So we need to define a construction period. And so you should not start the commencement date of the lease until you finish construction and you receive the keys and the CO, the certificate of occupancy, so you can start opening for business. So that's really important.
It's critical. I mean, because in our business, you don't have revenue until you have space. And so you really want to avoid using your working capital on rent. That's not, there's no revenue to be made on it. So,
right.
Yeah.
Another important thing here is, and a trick that landlords will say is, okay, we'll give you up to 90 days for construction. And if it's beyond that, then it automatically triggers the rent to commence. Well, that's what you do not want, because you had a construction delay, or if there's delays in permitting, that's outside
of
totally
your control. Right, exactly.
So you want to say it's completely up to the construction. You're going to work diligently to make sure that it's done on time, but never commit to a time frame that triggers you to start the lease.
And this is sort of the challenging part about these negotiations, is the landlord wants to start collecting revenue immediately. Mm-hmm. And so that's their mindset. And you want to not pay rent until you walk in the door and could have members paying rent, ideally. And so
exactly,
you're really trying to find some agreement in that area. And I think this is, again, another reason to use a broker that understands the business model, because if you're not using a Casey who understands that you can't generate revenue, there are tenants out there who, like, this is not as big of a deal. I mean, a big company, they have to pay rent when they sign a lease, they've secured the space, the cost of doing business. It's, you know, some people might sort of write that off, and a broker may not be as used to looking for this issue. But for us, it could eat up a lot of startup capital, especially if construction gets delayed.
Exactly. And one level add on to that is, you know, there's so much furniture that you're going to be putting into these co-working spaces. So always want to make sure that you have at least 2 to 4 weeks prior to completion of the work to get in and install your furniture. So you should not be paying for rent when you're just simply, you know, putting your furniture together. Again, you're not making revenue, so you should not be charged for rent. So that will start the commencement date whenever you have a substantial completion and you have a CO in hand and you open the doors for business, you're ready to go. That's when you theoretically could start rent. I want to advise my clients to defer or abate the base rent and operating expenses for as long as possible. So depending on which market you're in, that could be anywhere from 2 months to a year or even longer. That's another reason also why I advise my clients to go for a longer term. If you commit to 10 years, for instance, in the LA market, they'll give you typically a market condition where there would be 1 month per year. So you would get 10 months free in a 10-year commitment. So that helps your runway for getting in, stabilizing, generating revenue before you're hit with expenses. So major consideration. I think it's one of the most important things that affects your pro forma in this entire proposal.
Yeah, because you're going to have a ramp up. You're not opening with your space full. It could take 18 months, 2 years to kind of get to your operating level, which is another reason for that 10-year lease. Like, you've just gotten to sort of your normal occupancy rates. You know, it could take 18 months or a little more, and then you don't want your lease to end in 5 years because you just don't have enough time to generate a profit and pay for all that amazing construction you just did.
Exactly. Which, this is a complete side note, but I've seen so many proposals recently, or pro formas, where they take their revenue that they are projecting for their first year and then just automatically add a escalator of like 3% per year. In most cases, you haven't stabilized the revenue. So I don't think they should do that until the end of the second year, because they'll leave a lot of potential revenue on the table. So this is a complete side note, but for anyone listening, please build out that second year for revenue.
Yep, good point.
Okay, here's another, I think, put a star next to this one. This is hugely important. Renewal options. So again, you're protecting your asset here, and you want to make sure that the landlord cannot take the space back, for any reason they can trump up. So there's different ways you could do that. And most of the time, it'll be some very loose language saying that you'll be granted a renewal option. And sometimes it'll say what the rate is, and it'll be a fixed rate. That's kind of a hard thing to do. It's a gamble 10 years from now to try and guess what the rate's going to be. If I'm a landlord, I'm going to just keep on, if you have 2-3% escalations annually over 10 years, they're going to want to keep on that escalation. And that's not really true with market because it's a cycle. So it might go up and down. So you don't really want to play that game too far out. So for a 10-year lease, I would say it's based on fair market value. And really, you want to be at like 95% fair market value for the building or comparable buildings within like a 1 mile radius. And then you need to have some language that kind of dictates what happens if we don't agree on what fair market value is. So that language I've seen in a lease get to be 3 pages long. So it could be something the attorneys like to negotiate heavily on. It's something called baseball arbitration, where essentially the landlords comes up with a valuation of what they think the rent's worth. And then the tenant side comes up with a valuation, and then they share notes. If they don't agree or if they're beyond 5% apart, then they have a third party, and the third party arbitrator comes in, comes to their own assessment of the valuation. At that point, if they're on par and they're within that 5%, then they'll go with a third party arbitrator's valuation. So it's really tricky legal language, but you need to have renewal option there. Do not sign a lease without one. Exclusive use. So I used to represent retail tenants back in the day, and I represent quite large ones, Chuck E. Cheese and some of the, so really, really, that's a more fun one. But it's important. They want to protect their share of any of the money coming into a shopping center. And I think that's the same concept when it comes to the office space in an office building. They want to protect their share of what revenue could come into that proximity based on someone who just likes that building. So it's important to say, define what your use is and that you have a model which is based on licensing or membership agreements. And then also that would include co-working spaces, business centers, executive suites, the whole gambit for the flex space offering. But then also it could be regular tenants in the building that have decided to kind of alter their business model for instead of subleasing the space, they may try to sublease it out through a shared workspace model. So you want to define that so they can't do that, because ultimately anyone in a building could be a potential competitor down the road. I've heard a number of clients, especially on the corporate side, that have come to me in the past and said, hey, we have a pretty large portfolio. I don't think we need all this space. Can we turn around and start, use maybe 30% of the space in a building for co-working? So that question comes up often. And so I think that that'll only be happening more and more. So it's important to be protected on that. Another thing to consider here is when you're doing exclusive, you want to make sure you're setting boundaries for who your competitors are. It could be other tenants in the building, but it also could be the landlord. So,
That's happening more and more. I've had a couple of folks mention that's happening in their situation where they don't have this clause.
Right. So it could be that the landlord's trying to create spec suites, which is not a new concept, but they do it often somewhere between 1,000 to 2,500 square foot spaces. They build them out and they're plug and play and they're easy to do. And many tenants will end up taking those on. So those will be in direct competition with a co-working space. Yep. So we want to define that, okay, landlord, you already have these spaces. We don't want you to operate them anymore as spec suites. We don't want you to build out anymore. Any new tenant that comes in under 2,000 square feet would be a potential tenant for or potential member for the co-working space. So we should have first rights on that potential target. And then if it doesn't seem to be a good fit for the co-working, then they could go organically within the building. But you want to separate those rights.
What is sort of the boundary that you think is reasonable to set? I know you and I traded some emails with some folks who were trying to kind of make that number sort of larger than what I thought the landlord might agree to. Mm-hmm. It probably varies, but what's kind of reasonable?
Yeah, there's lots of compromises there. And so I think it's reasonable to say your first position should be 2,000 square feet, but I would keep your last fallback position at 1,000 square feet.
Okay.
So with a general, you know, reasonable concession being at 1,500 square feet within the, not only the building, but the, could be, if there's multiple buildings, it needs to be the entire complex.
Yep.
So I want, and that's a really important differentiator, because if there's two identical buildings right next to one another, you don't want to have a competitor right next to you.
I wonder, is this clause becoming more challenging to negotiate as landlords understand what the business model is and think, but I would like the right to do that myself if it comes up?
So I think they see it more as you're tying their hands with...
They want the option, at least...
They want the option, yeah, for smaller tenants. And well, the way I always describe it to them is, do you really want to be in the business of, you know, doing build outs for 1 to 2,000 square foot tenants who are doing 1 to 3 year terms?
Yeah.
It just doesn't make good financial sense. So it makes better sense for both parties to allow those shorter term tenants to come into our space. It alleviates all your CapEx so you can defragment your building. So we'll take all the small tenants and then let them mature and then grow organically. And so you have a more stabilized building. So I think that's the better approach. And once you explain it to them, they're more willing to accept that.
Yep.
But a lot of times I think it's the brokers that are pushing back, because it's tying their hands on, you know, easy potential
easy
targets
deals.
Coming to. Yeah.
Yep.
So that's something I would definitely, something that should be in your proposal. It should be in one of your first conversations with the landlord. One other thing to consider as the co-working continues to grow and grow with a large prevalence going towards Class A and Class B properties, the amount of buildings that are left that don't have exclusives are getting smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. So pretty soon, you know, in 10 years time, the amount of space that's available that's unencumbered, so unrestricted, could be pretty low. So it would make it very difficult. And it's hard to go out there and do a survey, because they don't define which ones have exclusive, which ones don't. You have to call every single one.
Okay. Interesting.
So that's something that there'll be, you know, problem in the future, but for now it's kind of a land grab.
Yep. Okay. Go to land grab and lock it in for 10 years so that you could at least buy yourself some time until there's more competition. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out for sure. Like, will there be enough demand for competition in the building? I mean, I know I can think of one in building, really nice building in San Francisco that has two operators in the building and both are full.
Yeah. But that tells me that one operator could have expanded and been more profitable.
Good point. Yep.
So,
gotta have the capital.
Yeah. And so in a million square foot building, it's going to be very, very difficult to get that exclusive unless you're willing to keep on expanding.
Yep.
So, okay. So going through some of this will be this next part where it talks about operating expenses and taxes and what's part of your lease. Maybe it's a good point to kind of, for some of the listeners that don't have a really broad understanding of terminology for real estate, real quickly. So full service lease means everything in one payment. And so it'd be your base rent, it'd be any operating expenses, your utilities, electric, everything's in one payment. But you also have a base year. So they establish what your first year is for operating expenses and real estate taxes and common area maintenance. And then after that first year, they'll do a reconciliation. And if that amount goes higher than your base year, then you might be charged the difference.
Yep.
So that's an important differentiator, because in some leases, you don't have that. So in a triple net lease, for instance, you just pay your base rent separate from that base year estimate. So they left the triple nets, which are the real estate taxes, common area maintenance, and the insurance for the property. They let those float as a variable, and you have to pay that regardless of what the variation is. So in your pro forma, make sure that you separate those line items, whether it's a full service lease or a triple net lease, because that could be a big factor.
Yep.
And whether there's a utilities included in the rent or not. You know, you need to, in your pro forma, you need to have an extra line item for each of these, because no two buildings are the same. Sometimes they charge you for water outside. Sometimes they charge you for electric outside. So you always have to just ask, what expenses do I pay outside my rent?
Got it.
So there are a couple of things you can do for your operating expenses that they do pass through to you. You can cap them. You want to cap the amount of increase that happens from year to year. Landlords are typically a little bit of resistance to this on the taxes because it's an uncontrollable. And so that's a direct pass-through. But where you can have a little more leverage is on controllable operating expenses. So we want to cap those at anywhere from, say, 3 to 5% is a reasonable amount. And that's typically things that are tied to, like, if the landlord can go out there and get a separate bid, then that's a controllable operating expense. But if they're bound to use one contractor, like a utility firm, a utility provider, then that's a non-controllable.
So it's like a cleaning service. He can't use his cousin's service, which is three times more than sort of market. You have the right to help that be controlled.
Exactly. Yep. I always call it the brother-in-law clause. So if they have a brother-in-law who has a landscaping company and he just wants to go from 1,000 per month to 10,000, if you don't have a cap on the controllable operating expenses, then they can pass that directly onto you and you don't have any say.
Yep.
So and that's really important. Okay. We talked about the right to renew, but there's two other areas that I think are important. The right to expand or the right to contract. So I like to put in that if you the tenants have the right to expand within a certain time frame, let's say 18 to 24 months, if you expand within 24 months, I like to say that the terms for that deal should be based on the terms we agreed to in this initial LOI or proposal. It's close enough to where it's close enough to the current market conditions. So we don't have to renegotiate everything. But it's after that time frame, then it would be based on market at that time.
Okay.
So that's an important differentiator because a lot of times you have groups that are coming in and say, okay, let's start with 7,500 square feet.
Yeah.
But once that lease is up, then I want to expand and the building. And so what happens if the landlord increases the rent by $10 or $20 a square foot, all of a sudden that doesn't really become feasible and it hurts your business model because you're thinking that you could expand freely on the same terms.
Yep.
So it's important to put that in there. And then contraction, that's less common, but basically what it says is you have the ability to give back space at any time with a notice to the landlord. And it's not through a sublease, it's not through anything. You see that on bigger corporate leases, if they're taking 40, 50, 60,000 square feet, and it helps them right size. But, you know, I don't see that as common if any co-working space is under 20,000 square feet. Signage is really important. I try to get as much signage as possible for co-working spaces because you're the front face for the building. So you need to be visible for members so they could see you and they see your brand and they associate with that. So the visitors need to be able to find you. So and it's a big differentiator from the Regis's back in the day when they didn't care about signages. They would just be on a plaque in the lobby. So I prefer to advise my clients to go into smaller buildings if possible. So you're a larger fish in the pond and so you have more leverage to get some type of exterior signage, but that's not always possible. Sometimes there's just great deals that come up and, you know, the rate is substantial enough to where you may not be as visible, but you're going to be killing it, you know, based on your SEO, you know, abilities. So I think it only helps you if you can.
I think this is one of those things. It's a great example of if you're not experienced in negotiations, you might think, oh, of course I'll get signage. The landlord's a nice guy. He'll give me some signage. I'll just worry about that later. Not how it works. I mean, there could be, you know, you just kind of talk through like a number of reasons why you're not going to get signage and you need to know that up front and you need to get it in writing, even though it seems like one of those, like, we'll work it out. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Not only are you probably not going to get signage if you're, let's say under a full floor of a, if you're taking less than 20% of a building, I would not expect to be on the top of a building. That's just a quick, you know, rule of thumb.
Good.
Typically, there's another anchor tenant that if you see a sign on top of the building, there's someone that already has rights there. So, you know, your ability to get signage is going to be subject to the landlord going back to them and asking them if they want to give up rights, which happens
probably not.
Rarely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it is possible. I mean, I was able to do that for one of my clients gathered in, you know, downtown Norfolk. We got them at the 15th and 16th floors of downtown high rise, and BB&T was vacating part of the building. And so we were able to take two of their signage positions out of the four. So it is possible, but we were taking two floors. So that gave some ability and some levers to get it.
Yep.
Right. And those things are costly too. You know, it's insane how much they can cost. I think a large part of it is based on, you know, renting the crane and the manufacturing of the signs, but yep. I would make sure you go get some bids before you just assume that it's going to be a couple thousand dollars.
Yep.
So, okay. Getting into the work portion of the build out. So I like to work it to where the landlords will provide a test bit, which is an initial preliminary space plan. And they'll take the space, if they have a CAD file, plug it into it, give it to their architect or give it to your architect and create a quick space plan or test fit. There's some great groups that are doing this. You know, Workplace Studio is one that does a great job of, you know, curating test fits for co-working groups. And they do it as a toehold to get in. Here's a potential way to create your design that would be revenue producing and minimize some of your expenses and use that as a negotiation for how much TI that you need. And then also it allows you to start working on your pro forma and start building out your projections of what you could hit revenue-wise. And I think it's important because I always advise my clients, do not sign a lease unless you've already run the pro forma and you know that you're profitable in a reasonable time frame.
You need to confirm it. You can't just guess based on square footage. It's too hard to guess.
Right.
And to account for, like you said, non-usable space and walkways and all the things that you simply don't know until you do the actual test fit.
Right. Yeah. Just in short, not all spaces are created equal. Some architects, building architects, have some really crafty designs and some angular, you know, windows. It just really creates an inefficient footprint for the floor. So it makes it harder for the architects to kind of work around and be efficient as you want to in order to generate a revenue that you're looking for. So I always advise, you know, get the landlord to provide a test fit allowance and then make it to where it's not contingent. If you, at the end of the day, you don't sign this LOI, you are not responsible for paying back that test fit fee. So it's a cost of doing business for the landlord. And surprisingly, you know, about 90% getting that approved by landlords.
That's great. Right. You need to know how to ask for it and know how to frame it and get it approved.
Right. Okay. And then getting into the construction side. And there's two different ways you could set up a construction. You could either be turnkey, where the landlord just pays for everything. You essentially agree on what the scope of work is, and the landlord assumes all costs. That's one way to do it. Another way to do it is through a tenant improvement allowance, where you estimate how much it's going to cost. You try to get as much TI allowance as possible. And then if your actual construction comes in higher than your TI allowance that the landlord provides you, then the tenant is responsible for paying for the difference. So it's important to know the difference between the two. In most cases, on a small scale, if you're looking at something, you know, 5,000 square feet or below, or minimal construction, meaning carpet paint, some demo, things like that. Those are the only scenarios where I would consider it's a good case to do a turnkey work. A lot of times, if they do a turnkey, they're overestimating how much it's going to cost, and they're going to build it into their rate. So it's better for you to say, look, I want to be as efficient as possible. You take away the variables of how much it's going to cost you for construction by just giving me a set dollar amount. I'll take on that assumed risk, but also I want the rate to be as efficient and lower as possible. So I like that scenario because typically in a larger case where you have 15, 20 or 40,000 square feet, you're going to have a construction manager who's going to be managing that process for you and going to, you know, actively curate a bidding process, and you're going to be able to value engineer all those bids. And then at the end of the day, if you get $75 a square foot in TI allowance from a landlord and your construction comes in at $60 a square foot, which would be a small miracle in a good working scenario.
It's like has never happened in the history of
right.
build outs, but.
Yeah, so this is a hypothetical scenario. The tenant could receive a reimbursement for the difference. So they could get that $15 delta back as a credit against rent or just as a check. So that's one of the reasons why I like getting the TI allowance, because it does provide some tenant preferred scenarios.
And it also just gives you more control over the trade-offs that you make. Like you're sort of directly managing where that value engineering comes in and, you know, where you're willing to give and not give on the budget.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then going down parking, well, I'm going to jump around a little bit. So the landlord's work is exhibit that attached to my proposal is essentially it sets what a base building definition is for the building. Landlords should provide these certain things regardless of what the allowance is, and it's not going to cost the tenant anything. And the reason I put this exhibit in there, which basically says, you know, the landlord needs to put in a drop ceiling, the landlord needs to provide electricity to the space, they need to provide the, you know, original trunk line for the HVAC throughout the primary distribution of space. Certain elements of this, I mean, my base building definition, if the landlord, if you're taking a cold, dark shell, meaning just concrete floors and no rough end walls, it's just exposed insulation and no drop ceiling, it could be up to $25, maybe $30 a square foot of value in having this. So basically a set, landlord's going to provide a vanilla box. And from there, that's when your TI dollars go to work.
Kick in. Yep.
So it, one way I kind of explain this is it helps us compare apples to apples because no two buildings are the same. They're always at different conditions. So if you do have one building that you're comparing proposals with and it's a raw shell, then, and you have this in place, then you can compare that equally with a second generation space that already has drop ceilings, has existing walls and existing electric and things like that. So those two are then equal. And then you just look at how much TI allowance you're getting from the landlords. So that kind of wraps up the construction portion of it. A couple final footnotes, and I just saw my notes at the end. So maintenance and repairs. If you're in a full service lease, then the landlords should be responsible for all maintenance and repair for the building, HVAC, electrical, plumbing, everything. If you're in a triple net lease, be prepared to pay for any repairs inside your premises. And one way that you could maybe mitigate some of your risk there is to cap what your exposure is. So you may be able to negotiate a cap of what your out-of-pocket expenses are in a given year. I think that's one way to work around that. If you're large enough as a percentage of the building, I always encourage my clients to get a non-disturbance agreement. So a non-disturbance agreement will basically allow you to stay in space. If the building gets taken over or taken back from a bank and the bank decides that they want to remove the existing tenants in order to restructure the building and make it more profitable to lease it to one full tenant, mm-hmm. they could do that unless you have a non-disturbance agreement.
Okay.
So typically, you would have to get this. It's a separate document. It's a legal document. You'd have to get the lender, the landlord's lender, to sign off when you sign the lease at that same time. If you do not get them to sign off, then they are not recognizing the non-disturbance agreement.
When is that worth pushing for?
If you're more than, I would say, 15 to 20,000 square feet in a 300,000 square foot building, I would push for it. Anything under 20,000 square feet, unless you're in a building that's maybe 20 to 30,000 square feet, I wouldn't push for it. I mean, push for it, but don't
it's not a deal breaker.
Most of the time, they just don't want to go to the lender and ask for it. So it's really just a matter of pain and time.
Got it. Yep.
Parking is critical for co-working. As you know, the landlords typically will say you have a certain allowance based on a parking ratio for the building. So this building will allow 4 per 1,000 or 3.5 per 1,000 parking spaces on a reserved basis. And sometimes there'll be a rate for that, and sometimes there won't. And so you want to make sure you define what the unreserved rates are, and if there is a reserved rate, what that is, and then try to get some of those reserved parking spaces put in for free into your lease. If you have, you know, anything over 15,000 square feet, you should be able to have enough leverage to get a couple spaces reserved. And typically that's not for the community manager to use. So they don't have to walk very far to their space. And so you're going to have an easy visitor space. So it provides a little less friction for your members' visitors when they're trying to find a space. You can, and you know, clearly point out to them there's a sign where the visitors are parked there. You walk through the space. So it becomes an easier process. So always try to get, you know, at least 2 to 3 visitor spaces that are reserved.
Makes total sense. Any other closing remarks?
Last things. So the security deposit and the securitization of the lease. So this is kind of iffy. 50-50 on whether you include it or not. You know, if you know that you're going to get a lot of money for the landlord for the build out, if you're building out from scratch and you're talking about millions for the landlord, then know right off the bat that you're going to need some type of securitization, which is essentially like a guarantee of your lease and commitments. I will not put that language in there for a small lease if we know that we're going to come in with less improvements. It's less risk for the landlord. So I've tried to defer that and get them to, you know, while we're in this dating stage, to stay happy and focus on, hey, you're going to, it's minimal risk. Let's focus on getting this deal done. And then I'm really successful that once we get to the lease, either getting them to forget about that obligation or defer as long as possible until they say, hey, we've already gone down this road for 2 months. Let's just get the deal done.
Yep.
But if you're asking them for $1 million or $2 million upfront, that's the first thing they're going to talk to you about. So I would upfront disclose, hey, we understand that there's a liability here. We'd like to address as many of these terms as possible. But while we're doing that, here's how we would like to address the securitization of the lease. And how I typically structure that is, if you can contain that to the amount of money that the landlord is putting out of pocket, it's not your total rental consideration for the entire term of the lease.
Yep.
Just the amount of out of pocket from the landlord.
Yep.
That's a way to mitigate what that potential exposure is, and then have a burn off where if you're in good performance and standards for the lease for paying on time, then you have an acceleration for that burn off. So your liability drastically goes down in the, you know, first, let's say 1 to 5 years of the lease. So after 4 or 5 years, if you pay on time, then you don't have a large, substantial amount of securitization that's kind of hanging over you.
Yeah. So you're trying to reduce the landlord's risk that he puts in $1 million on a build out, your business doesn't work, you're out, he doesn't have a security deposit, he's got downtime on the space, and he's dropped $1 million on the build out, which he then may need to spend again on a new tenant that comes in. So to your point, you're not giving security for the total value of your lease, but at least his out of pocket, so to say, costs on the build out cost, or the TI dollars, I guess.
You're minimizing the amount of guarantee. So yep. That could either be through a personal guarantee or a corporate guarantee. So if it's corporate guarantee, the LLC, or maybe it's being backed by a corporate entity, that's who's mitigating and minimizing their risk. If it's a personal guarantee, that literally goes to the signers or the guarantors of the lease personally. So the very last case scenario, I do not advise my clients to take on personal guarantees unless they've explored every other avenue first.
Yep, got it. Casey, this was like mini class in space proposals. Thank you for going through in so much detail. This was really, really helpful. I know, like we talked at the beginning, you see a million of these, but for most folks, it's the first time they've ever seen one, and it might look a little overwhelming or intimidating, or you'd be tempted to sort of gloss over it and not kind of dive into the details. And I think you've really illustrated today that the details are important and you need to go through the process, even if it feels painful and takes longer than you would like it to. And you need someone in your court that really understands the business risks and the business model so that they can really negotiate for the right terms.
Right. No, so I appreciate that. Like there. So I think it is really important. I strongly advise anyone listening to make sure that they're being represented by a broker at the minimum. But if they are in the middle of a negotiation and there are, you know, hiccups and they're kind of stalling out because of certain things, you know, feel free to reach out to me. I'm willing to kind of help, kind of maybe offer some advice on how to compromise on some of these areas, because it's not just about, you know, sticking in your feet and saying, no, we're not going to do this. You know, ultimately, everyone compromises. It's just a matter of how much you're willing to give up. So, you know, feel free to use me as a resource. I'm happy to kind of share with some life experiences and maybe some stories on, you know, scenarios where I was able to be successful or not successful and you know, potential compromises. So happy to help.
Awesome. And Casey at flexspaceadvisors.com. And I will stick that in the show notes so that you can easily find it. Casey, thank you for your time today and for sharing so much detailed, good information. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Look forward to it.
Until next time.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Everything Coworking. Be sure to click the subscribe button so you can stay up to date on the latest trends and how-tos. Until next time.